Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. Hello. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Thank you all for joining us for this evening's event with Jan Martell. It's a pleasure to welcome him back to the library for this new book, The High Mountains of Portugal. So we thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Here's, one more thing. I want to acknowledge that we have with us tonight the Consul General of Canada, James Hill. We have Michael Wolf and Harkiran Rajasansi, also from the Consul General's office, so please also welcome them. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us for this program tonight. We're here, of course, to hear Jan Martell, author of The High Mountains of Portugal. We've had many opportunities, well, several opportunities, to actually hear Jan Martell in Seattle, and quite a memorable one happened before he won the Man Booker Prize for his novel Life of Pi. And that was hosted at Elliott Bay, and so we're pretty excited about that. And he's also been here on the paperback tour, and then also here at the library for Beatrice and Virgil, which itself was a prize winner. It was a winner of the Financial Times Fiction of the Year, and also it was longlisted for the 2012 International Impact Dublin Literary Award. So tonight he's here with The High Mountains of Portugal, a new novel set during three periods in the 20th century in Portugal. And it's one that is, of course, informed by the meticulous research that he does to put you in the context of each period. But I think it is the characters, both human and not, that have drawn many readers to him, and will both with this book and with previous ones. I'd like to quote something that Ron Charles from the Washington Post wrote about this book. Ron Charles is one of our wonderful national book reviewers. There's fewer of them now. And he wrote, Martell's writing has never been more charming, a rich mixture of sweetness that is not cloying and tragedy that is not melodramatic. The High Mountains of Portugal attains an altitude from which we can see something quietly miraculous. And this is Ron Charles, who writes for the Washington Post. So tonight, Jan Martell will speak. He'll read a bit from his book. He'll take questions from the audience about this book and others. So please welcome Jan Martell to the Seattle Public Library.
Thank you very much, Karen. Thank you to Elliott Bay, which is a fabulous independent bookstore. When I go on tours of the United States, I mostly go on tours of independent bookstores. And in your crazy country, you have remarkable independent bookstores. And Elliott Bay is really at the top of the list. So I think we were counting it was my fifth time doing something with Elliott Bay, and my second time here in this beautiful library that you have. Thank you to the Consul General and the entirety of the Consulate General being here. I appreciate that. You should get to know them because, you know, when in the first days of President Trump, they will help you in when you claim your refugee status to go to Canada. So I am here to talk about the High Mountains of Portugal. I'm not going to read, actually. I find, frankly, you could read the book yourselves if you're interested. I'd rather just talk to you about the book. And we'll have a question period. Don't be shy. You can ask me about Life of Pi if you want. It's totally fine, or any other book I've written. So this latest book, as Karen was briefly describing, is called The High Mountains of Portugal. And it's funny, when you write, you have a certain intent, and very quickly that intent is taken over by how people receive it. So author intent is quickly taken over by reader reception. And I'm already seeing this with The High Mountains of Portugal, which only came out on the 2nd, so 9 days ago. So to me it is a novel, and I always thought of it as a novel, but people are describing it as a novel in three novellas, as if they're sort of three separate standalone things, which they're not in my mind, but they may be in yours. But it is in three distinct sections, one taking place in 1904, one in 1939, and one in the early 80s, each with different characters, but to me very clearly linked by certain events and a certain theme, obviously. And my feeling is that in part two, you'll see things from part one show through, and in part three, you'll see things from parts one and two show, sort of like a palimpsest. For this one, I did my usual research. I like doing research. I think all fiction has to be rooted to some kind of factuality as a starting point, and then you go far beyond that. And so I did my usual research into factuality. In this case, automobiles. Part one features a road trip, a 1904 Renault. So a very, very early automobile, very rudimentary automobile. Actually very luxurious, rudimentary automobile. And so I did my research on that. I once again use animals in this novel. I can explain why in a second. So in this case, it's a chimpanzee and a rhinoceros. And I'd already done some research on rhinoceroses because, in fact, for Life of Pi, for the longest time, the tiger was going to be a rhinoceros. But fortunately for me, the rhinoceros is a herbivore, and I didn't see how I'd keep a herbivore alive in the Pacific. There's very little grass that grows in the Pacific. So I had done research already on rhinoceroses, but I hadn't on chimpanzees. So I did research on the higher apes, the greater apes. And also there's an element of to do with pathology and with Agatha Christie. So I did my research on pathology. I saw two autopsies. I read all the novels of Agatha Christie from 1920 to 1938, when that part of the novel takes place. I loved doing that. That was fascinating. I loved Agatha Christie already, but I never read her systematically. It was wonderful doing that. And then I sort of brought it together, and that's the sort of the trampoline. That was the starting point of the story. I would say that the High Mountains of Portugal is of the same kind as Life of Pi, in that it's a literary exploration of religion. And I emphasize literary in the sense that, well, I'm Canadian, first of all. We don't do crazy evangelical quite the way you do it in the United States. Mind you, I shouldn't speak for Albertans. My background is entirely secular. I grew up in the secular mainstream of Canada. From Quebec, I'm originally from Quebec, which is the most secular part of Canada and therefore likely the most secular part of North America, where it went from being deeply, darkly Catholic to the most social democratic, secular province in Canada. And I grew up in that ambiance. My parents were children of what was called the Quiet Revolution in Quebec, and I was a grandson of it. So in my household, in my home when we were growing up, religion was entirely replaced by art. Religion was viewed purely in anthropological terms as something that people in Papua New Guinea do and that people in Rome do. It was sort of viewed just as a sociocultural trait. And art replaced it entirely as the way to understand who we were, why we were. You know, if you want to understand the human condition, you read great novels, listen to great music, look at great paintings. And that was a wonderful way to grow up, especially since my parents were diplomats, and I had the great fortune of living 10 years of my life in Paris, spending summers in Madrid, living a year in Mexico. So I saw, the dizzying art that great, great cities can deliver. Nonetheless, by the time I got in my early 30s, and I should also mention that I studied philosophy at university, which is another way of making you quite secular. Religion has a difficult time surviving the rigors of philosophy. Nonetheless, by the time I got to my early 30s, I happened to go to India following a girl, and it didn't work out with the girl, but I did fall in love with India. And one of the things that I noticed about India that really struck me is the extraordinary manifestations of religion in India. Hinduism is fundamentally a monotheistic religion, but the divine is expressed in many, many, many ways, each of which is named. So it gives the appearance of being polytheistic like the Greek religion, but it isn't. Nonetheless, the multiple manifestations of it means that Hindus, not in a sort of dogmatic, thought-out way, but more in a gut way, are quite tolerant of other expressions of the divine. They don't have that exclusive vision of the truth that, for example, Christianity has. So if you look at the reception that Christian missionaries had in India compared to Christian missionaries in Japan, it's radically different. In Japan, they were captured, tortured, executed, because Shintoism had an exclusive view of the world, of the cosmos, which Christianity directly threatened, they perceived. Whereas in India, when Christian missionaries first appeared, the Hindus didn't have the same reaction. In fact, in Hinduism, the Krishna displays the same kind of loving kindness that we associate with Jesus. So there wasn't at all a sense of threat, and Christianity did, establish itself quite early on in India, because the Hindus, I think, at some sort of level said, they sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, Jesus, just another god in the pantheon, bring him in. And so Christianity did quite well, and so there is an extraordinary variety of religious manifestations in India, which you really see everywhere. Hinduism, of course, with its 800 million practitioners, is on view everywhere, on display everywhere, whether it's the way people dress, pilgrimages, temples, tiny temples, big temples, massive temples, entire cities sort of taken over by it, like Varanasi. But there's also, a minority of Muslims, non-minority, I think it's 250 million of them. That's a minority by Indian standards. And then you have Christians, Buddhists, of course. Buddhism started in India. Jains, Sikhs. They're all there in extraordinary numbers. And so I saw that for the first time. And rather than seeking the negative, like a lot of secular people, I knew just enough about religion to dislike it. So I grew up noticing things like the sexism of religion, the anti-Semitism of Christianity, the paternalism. All of which are true. Organized religion continues to inflict that on us. But in India, for the first time, I saw other aspects that were benign and quite beautiful. And that is the simple acts of faith of individuals who are not out to judge or condemn, let alone do violence upon anyone. And that touched me. And so I decided to, in Life of Pi, because in each of my books that I write, I'm exploring something. I'm trying to clarify my thinking about something. The reason I write my books is simply to explore a foreign reality, to make it more familiar, to understand it better. And so I decided to look at that very odd phenomenon called faith. That was specifically what I was interested in looking at, which is why I have practiced three religions, because I was going to relativize organized religion so I could really look at that act, that bizarre act called faith, that is so against the ethos of our modern times, where we are so encouraged to be pragmatic, to be reasonable, and of course with good reason. Modernity and its triumphs has immeasurably improved our lives. Everything in this room speaks of close attention to detail. This sound system, the lights, the architecture, your clothing, everything speaks of the triumph of technology. So that's not to be put into question. Nonetheless, we're not entirely to be reduced to our reasonable accomplishments. We're not computers. We're not machines. And faith is a perfect example of that ineffable part of us that can't be reduced to reason. So in India, I sort of noticed faith, and I thought, I'll look at this thing. What an odd phenomenon. And so I posited this character who practices three faiths, and I wrote Life of Pi. The High Mountains of Portugal is sort of a follow-up on that, in that once again, from a dispassionate sort of secular perspective, I want to look once again at faith, which I continue to find a fascinating subject. And I first of all started this novel in some of its very small elements about 30 years ago when I was at university. In my early 20s, I fancied myself a writer, and so I started working on a novel. But I was much too immature to figure out how to do that. I didn't have the breadth, I didn't have the breadth to write a novel. Nonetheless, it took place in Portugal. It featured an animal, and it also featured a crucifix. And those elements, to a certain extent, have remained. Now, the crucifix is different. The animal is different. In this case, in the earliest incarnation of the novel, it was a talking dog. Flip the word around. But it didn't come alive. I just put it aside, and I moved on to write other things. And then those of you who read Life of Pi will remember in the author's note, the author goes to India, meaning to work on a novel set in Portugal. And that was that same Portuguese novel that I was trying to have another go at, and once again, it wasn't coming alive. So I once again put it aside. And finally, only a few years ago did I finally sort of figure out how I could do this. And the trigger was a very casual observation. Once again, as I said, I sort of go in and out of religion, just looking at, sort of like, you know, Howard Carter going up and down the Nile Valley, looking at the sands of the Nile, the banks of the Nile, trying to look for artifacts, and occasionally I find things. And in this case, I noted something in a very casual way. I happened to be flipping through the Gospels, and really it was very casual. It just happened the book was on my table, and in moving it, I just sort of flipped through it, and I noticed something I never noticed before, which was that in the Gospels, the Gospels are very short, right? They're remarkably concise documents because they emanate from oral tales, so they're not very lengthy. And there's four of them, and none of them are very long. And despite that, each of them are divided by little section headings. You know, Jesus cures a leper, for example. All these mini chapter headings, just to help you navigate the text. I noticed that, and it suddenly occurred to me that these very direct, unironic chapter headings provided a very, very succinct summary of the life of Jesus. If you just looked at the chapter headings, it would give you a sense of the narrative arc of that gospel. Now, some are a bit puzzling. They don't reveal much. Like, there's one chapter called The Tradition of the Elders. That doesn't give you much. You actually have to read the chapter to know what the tradition of the elders is speaking about. But some are very, you know, explicit. I said, Jesus cures a leper. Sure enough, in that chapter, Jesus cures a leper. So it occurred to me, and I asked myself, I wonder if I could tell a story using those chapter headings as a parallel. In other words, writing an allegory on the life of Jesus, but more specifically using those chapter headings as my guideline. So the first drafts of this novel, instead of being a novel that's in three continuous sections, was a novel in 78, I forget how many chapters Mark has, I think 79 or 83 little chapters. So my first draft had all those chapter headings, and sometimes what would happen there reflected directly what happened, what the chapter heading said, and sometimes there was a commentary on it. So sometimes there's varying degrees of irony. My editors hated that. They found it really cumbersome. First of all, most of us don't really know the Gospels at all. It's not so much fading. Well, it's fading sort of as a document that we're vividly aware of. So first of all, they were maddened by the fact that they didn't really know what I was talking about. So they felt the obligation to find a gospel and read it. And then it was possibly illuminating, but it was also doing this zigzag between reading my manuscript and reading the Gospel of Mark and then going back, made for disruptive reading. So they said, it's driving us crazy. So I capitulated, and I said, okay, I'll take those out. So I took out the chapter headings, and now we just have the narrative. But then ultimately, and when you tell a story, you have to serve your own story. So now I started cutting some, rearranging some. But nonetheless, those of you who have passing familiarity with the Gospel of Mark, which is the shortest, oldest one, may notice some similarities. So I'll just give you one example. There's a scene in part one where the character is afflicted with lice and fleas, something. Anyway, he's scratching himself to oblivion. He's insane with itchiness. And at one point, he wonders, how did he get these? So he asks himself the question, who touched me? Who touched me? And if you remember, there's a scene where a woman who's been hemorrhaging for 12 years comes up to Jesus and touches his hem. And the power goes out of him and immediately heals her. And Jesus realizes this and says, he turns around and says, who touched me? Who touched me? In this case, it's a woman who's, you know, he passed on to her. He cured her. So there's one. That was the one parallel. So you'll see, if you're familiar with the Gospels, a parallel. But the point anyway is to tell my own story. And what was very curious is that very quickly, from just having this intent of telling a parallel and not knowing where it was going, in thinking about it, it very quickly broke into these three very distinct sections, and each with a very different tone. Christianity is interesting. All the things that I said about religion, by the way, everything that I'm saying here about religion is whether you care about it or not. It's just sort of a viewing from the outside as a fascinating thing to look at. What's interesting about Christianity is it's the only religion that I know of that postulates its negation, that postulates it not being true. If you look at Mark, it ends with the Lord on the cross saying, "Oh Lord, oh Lord, why have you forsaken me?" So here you have the Son of God being crucified, and he's, instead of saying, you know, Father, I'll be with you soon, or what he says in other Gospels, you know, forgive them, they know not what they are doing. No, he says, Father, oh Father, why have you forsaken me? So in this, and that's pretty well how the Gospel according to Mark ends, with this sort of note of atheism in a theistic document. So you don't see that in other religions. You also, of course, don't see God's dying in other religions. I think that's why the Christianity was so startling 2,000 years ago, people had never encountered a religion where gods died. You know, in the Greek religion, the gods don't die. In Hinduism, they don't die. You just don't die when you're a god, in a sense, by definition. They cavort on Mount Olympus or wherever they will cavort, and we suffer and lead our miserable lives way down below the mountain. There isn't this them living like us. And so that's why it was so startling. So in this very human expression of religion, there are moments of doubt. And that very quickly started expressing itself in my book. So if I was going to really simplify this novel, part one might represent atheism, the negation of faith, or the taking on of a negative faith, which is more strictly speaking what I think atheism is. Part two, you might consider the wavering, uncertain grounds of agnosticism, where you are not sure. And then part three might resemble theism, you know, living with the belief confidently. So each has a different emotional tone. And I sort of reversed the part one, 1904, despite being the furthest away from us in time, I meant to try to give it the most modern feel. So it's a road trip in which a curator in a museum named Tomáš, is overwhelmed by technology. In this case, it's 1904 Renault. He needs to find this object in the very northeast of the country. And his uncle, his wealthy uncle, lends him an automobile. And Tomáš doesn't know how to drive it. And it's a very cumbersome thing to drive. And so he's completely overwhelmed by technology, the way I think in many ways we are overwhelmed by technology today. Technology is supposed to be a means to an end. And bizarrely, it seems to be a means that sometimes never gets us to our end. We're so busily in that means of technology, we never quite are aware of what the end is. So part three, which is the closest to us in time, the early 80s, in fact, I meant to have the feel of being the one in the greatest antiquity. In that part three, you will see that the main character lives in a place with no electricity. He gives up using his watch. There's running water, but no hot water. He lives an extremely sort of simple life. And I was trying to, in a sense, have it closest in time, but have the feel of timelessness. When I write, I make discoveries. I plan very carefully. And one of the things I sort of hit upon, and when you write a book, there are certain sections that you write just to get from A to B. And they're necessary, and you may still like them, but they don't explode in your mind. And whereas other sections are a real joy to write. And one of them, ones that for me, was in part two. There's a section where there's a character who, in part two, there's a pathologist who's working late at night trying to catch up on work. And two women, one after the other, come and knock on his door to talk to him. And the first one is his wife. And she arrives announcing to him that she has the solution. And he wasn't aware that there was a problem. So he listens to her. And she, at one point, expostulates this theory linking the Gospels with Agatha Christie. And it was one of the joys of writing this book that I'd always been sort of interested in Agatha Christie, and mainly puzzled as to why she is the most popular author in the history of the world. No one has sold more books than Agatha Christie, not by a long shot. She's sold an extraordinary number of copies of her books in the Western world, but also every other language. I think it's close to 6 billion. It's an extraordinary number. It's unparalleled in the history of the written word. And I always wondered to myself, why? You know, of course she's entertaining, but so are other books. They're a genre fiction. You know, there's no great universality, one might think, to Agatha Christie. It's very much genre fiction. You know, she never won any big awards because it wasn't literary enough, people thought. She's also very rooted in a culture. She's exceedingly English, Agatha Christie. In her observations, in her sense of humor, in many of the settings, many of them are set in England. Some, of course, are set abroad, but many are set in England. You know, she's exceedingly English. So how peculiar that this exceedingly English writer should be popular in China, in all places of the world. So I always wondered why, and then I had this insight that I think she is so popular because, in a sense, she replicates unwittingly what the Jesus event did 2,000 years ago, which is to talk about death in a palatable way. We all are aware we're going to die, and we're all afraid of that, and we more or less try to avoid death, but we more or less, on occasion, think about it, either because of our aging parents or things we read about in the newspaper. Death sort of always hovers around us. And a really upsetting encounter in death. You know, you see someone have an accident in a street, or a terrible tragedy of a child being killed or something. It really upsets us, and we don't like that. We want to kind of push it away. Sometimes it forces itself upon us, and we're sad and upset, and then eventually we try to push it away. We try to impose forgetfulness on it. So we play with a certain proximity with death while trying to push it away. And what Agatha Christie does extraordinarily is that she makes death palatable by making it so entertaining. The murder mystery was, the murder was never so entertaining as with Agatha Christie. And yet, it's entertaining, and yet it's set within a moral framework, isn't it? They are murder mysteries, and at the end of each one, you always find out who did it. So even if it's an odious person who's murdered, and in many cases it is, I mean, Appointment with Death, the woman who gets murdered is a terrible woman. Murder on the Orient Express, if you've read the book or seen the movie, you remember, he's a terrible person. She modeled the victimizer, the murderer, on the Lindbergh case, the man who killed Charles Lindbergh's and Anna Lindbergh's baby son, who goes out and kidnaps a baby boy and kills him. So even if the murder is heinous, you nonetheless need to find out who did it. So it's murder within a moral framework. There's no nihilism in Agatha Christie. So it deals with death, with unjust death, within a moral framework, and in a delightfully entertaining way, you are in proximity to death. You somehow feel you've been close to that terrible thing you don't want to be close to, but it's been quite delightful. So death has been made palatable. What's interesting about the Jesus event is that, unlike any other religion of that time, where, as I said, the gods cavort up above and we die, we live miserable lives, and really there's no... Think of the Greek religion, which in a sense was profoundly amoral. It didn't matter if you were good or bad. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time in the Trojan War, you got a spear in your chest and that was the end of you. And whether you're a good man or a bad man, you know, it didn't really matter. You suffered and it had no sense. It was basically religions of the absurd. And suddenly you have this man who comes along and once again discusses death, but in a palatable way. Why is it palatable? Because he resurrects. Here's a man. So he's not a god up there. He's a man. He walks the earth like we do. He sweats like we do. He's hungry like we do. He gets angry at a fig tree because it doesn't have figs and he's hungry. He's human like us. He dies, but then he resurrects. And that had been unparalleled. And I think it was that startling to the Western imagination 2,000 years ago, what Jesus did with death, as in a sense, in a more unconscious way, Agatha Christie did with death in the 20th century. She startled us by being entertaining and therefore palatable about it, and he made death palatable by resurrecting. That's not really Jesus who did that, of course, he was Paul. But anyway, so I made this sort of link, and you'll see in the book I made all these parallels between, and they are remarkably similar. If you've never read an Agatha Christie, read a handful of them, and then try yourself at reading a gospel, and you'll see how they operate in very, very similar ways. I'll give you just a couple examples. The role of the witness. Right away you'll say, well, murder mystery, of course there has to be witnesses. That's the first thing you think of. There's a body. Who saw anything? And then the police interrogator, Hercule Poirot or Jane Marple, will go around asking people, what did you see, etc. And then you start, and of course the witnesses are always slightly inconsistent, aren't they? One person said, I saw this, the door was closed. Another person says, oh, no, the window was open. And it's through these discrepancies that the truth comes out. Well, it's the same thing in the Gospels. Think of them. There's four of them. It's not one Gospel. There's four canonical Gospels and a whole bunch of non-canonical ones, but there's four different Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And not only are they different, they're actually inconsistent. They say different things about the Jesus event, the role of the witness, and the role of the witness in other ways too. In the many of the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie, the ones by which feature Hercule Poirot, the narrator is a man named Arthur Hastings. It was very much on Agatha Christie's part taking of the model of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Same thing with Dr. Watson is the one who writes the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, murder, adventure, detective stories. In this case, it's a man named Arthur Hastings, who is remarkably obtuse. He's such a stupid man, happens to be a good writer. And it's interesting how he's writing stuff, and he just doesn't get it. He's so stupid. And it takes Hercule Poirot to say, but Arthur, did you not notice this? And then Arthur Hastings says, oh, no, I hadn't. And we have the same reaction, because you know what? We're just as dumb as Arthur Hastings. We also are missing all these clues, and it takes Hercule Poirot to illuminate things for us to see what happened. And you go back to the Gospels, it's the same thing. All these apostles were as stupid as Arthur Hastings. Jesus keeps on saying things, and they're not getting it. he has these wonderful parables, and they're sort of scratching their heads, so he has to explain the parables. The role of the witness who is obtuse, you see them in the Gospels and Agatha Christie. Another thing, too, and this is a very peculiar thing, if you anyone who've read an Agatha Christie, it's very odd how you never forget who the victim is. So Agatha Christie can name a murder mystery, the murder of Roger Ackroyd, and she doesn't ruin anything. Or she can call one Lord Edgware Dies. And it doesn't, you know, that you know who the victim is in no way takes away from the story. And yet what's remarkable is how quickly we forget the murderer. The key thing we're looking for, we forget. You read an Agatha Christie in the grip of compulsion, you get to the end, you find out who did it. It's so extraordinarily clever that the murderer, his or her hand was so cool, the thinking was so calculating. It comes like a real illumination, this aha moment, because of course she's laid little clues throughout. If you're a very, very careful reader, you can actually detect things that should have given you a hint, but you didn't see them. And so when it comes, it's a real moment of illumination, and yet it's remarkable how quickly we forget who the murderer is. So you pick up an Agatha Christie and you sort of say, did I read this one? Who did it? And you sort of, you can't remember. And you have to read 50 pages and sort of say, right, I remember. So for example, I don't know if anyone here has read, you know, Murder on the Links, on the golf links, Murder on the Links. It's, I think, one of our most incredibly convoluted one. And I'll bet you'll read it and 2 weeks later you'll be scratching trying to remember who did it again. I can't remember. Same thing with the Gospels. We obviously know who the victim is. Most of us don't even remember who the victimizer was. Who, in a sense, killed Jesus? We don't really know. It doesn't seem important. And, of course, it's not important because the point is he had to die to take on our burden of sin. So it wasn't particularly important who did it. There was a certain prescribed anonymity to the murderer. But nonetheless, it's curious. You have a victim, and we don't know who the victimizer is. Once again, it matches. Anyway, so all that, that was a particularly joyful section to write. There's these moments where, in writing, you bring things together. And, of course, it's done for a point. When Dr. Lazora's wife says to her husband, I have the solution because there's a problem, you'll see later on as you read that section why she is linking these two documents, the Jesus event and the Agatha Christie novels. I don't want to go on for too long. You see, otherwise I just sort of ramble. Do you have any questions or observations? Be happy to answer any questions you might have. Yes. No, I didn't even know this. I'll have to research that. Just a gentleman had a comment on what religion life of Richard Parker, the tiger in Life of Pi, would have practiced. And very obviously, you're right. A tiger would be Darwinian. That would be its religion, survival of the fittest. So definitely it would be the top of the evolutionary ladder and therefore Darwinian. A quick commentary on that in terms of religion. You're right that he chooses all three. And I remember I chose those religions carefully because I only found two religions that were definitely incompatible, and that was Judaism and Christianity. You know, you can't be waiting for the Messiah on Saturday and then celebrating him on Sunday, or only for 1 week, and then you have to choose one or the other. But I sort of regretted not getting Judaism in there, in part because there's no synagogues in Pondicherry, in Eastern, on the east coast of India. There are some in on the west coast in Kolam, I forget the city. But it was really interesting in writing Life of Pi, looking at comparative religion, seeing the different feel of each religion. I used the metaphor at one point in Life of Pi that religions are like wells, and they're different wells, but they all reach the same divine groundwater. But it's definitely not the case that they're sort of all the same. It's remarkable. In fact, if you look at if you go from Buddhism, which is nearly an atheistic religion, to highly incarnate religions, like Christianity or like Islam, or Hinduism, where there's a billion representations of gods. You go into temples, and there's if you go into temples in the south of India, where you have these things called gopurams, which are these pyramid structures full of sculptures, you have, you know, a million figurative representations of Hinduism, whether gods or goddesses, characters in Hindu stories. Really, it's such a figurative religion. And then the other polar opposite, of course, is Islam, where there's no figurative representations within mosques. You only have these lovely geometric symbols, but there is no representation of the human figure. So it's extraordinary, the variety, and I've always found that very bracing. And it also, what comes out is that they are fundamentally very different in the sense that they all nourish the hungry religious soul, but they nourish it in a different way. So I've always been struck, if you wanted to reduce each religion to something, it would give it a very different feel. So, you know, if you reduce Christianity to one single word, I think quite obviously it would be the word love. The strong focus of Christianity is love and what it means and how it's put into practice. It comes over and over again. You know, when Jesus says, love each other the way I've loved you, the operative word there is love. Then you have to figure out how did he love his disciples, and it yields a very complex thinking. If you had to summarize Islam to one single word, it would be unity. There's a remarkable unity in Islam. It's a very social religion. There's a strong sisterhood and brotherhood of Islam. And what happens in one country of the world to Muslims deeply matters to other Muslims. Hence the tensions that arise when Muslims here, let's say, feel angry because of what happened to Muslims in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Iraq and Iran. The anger that really circulates, like a pipe, like with water, it really circulates in their belief system. And Hinduism I find lovely because of the way it's so subtly and reflects the human psyche, kind of like the Greek myths that so accurately reflect who we are through stories. Hinduism does that too. And also Hinduism is wonderful because it's so varied. There is no central orthodoxy in Hinduism. It's an extraordinarily heterodox religion. So all of those, it was interesting seeing their feel in studying it for Life of Pi. No, in all cases an expression of faith, but I just mean the one that's in part one is a more negative one. It's an angry rejection of any sort of divine plan. So it doesn't last. You will see that it's in being negative, Tomas comes to a negative end. He's not satisfied with that negation. I guess he feels he's chosen the wrong faith. I always leave an element of mystery in these novels in this novel in particular, but all my ones, in terms of what happens next. To a certain extent, you have to figure out what will happen next with Tomas's character. So no, I hasn't. Don't forget, this is a different novel. So I haven't changed my opinion that, atheism is a kind of faith. In this case, it's just that he chooses a very negative one that doesn't satisfy him. Whereas there's other cases of atheists who are quite happy being atheists. You can construct meaning out of sort of a cosmic nothingness that we're just the result of chance chemistry. You know, a lot of people live like that. Entire systems are based like that, like obviously Marxism, you know, based on materialism. That's possible. I just don't find it necessarily very satisfying. A good question on process. How do I balance my research and my writing? Very easy answer. I do my research first, then my writing. So I fill up, as you say, with like Life of Pi was very obvious, the research I did, you know, on religions, all three of them. I read primary texts and secondary texts. I explained those texts. I did research on shipwrecks and survival at sea. I did research on animal behavior. And I had an original, like for example, Life of Pi, I just needed a tiger in a lifeboat. I didn't particularly care how that tiger got there. So initially I thought it would be a circus. I thought, why would a circus be traveling in a ship? That seems crazily implausible. And circuses are kind of hokey fictional device. So I dropped that and said, okay, maybe it'll just be, tigers are very good swimmers, so it'll be a tiger that's swept out to sea somehow. But that seemed kind of implausible, that a ship would sink, a boy's in a lifeboat, and out of the blue comes a tiger pushed adrift by the currents. It didn't seem very plausible. So I thought, well, how about a zoo? Then I thought, oh God, I'm already taking on religion, and most Canadians hate religion, so now I'm going to take on zoos, which, you know, most urban people hate too. So I'm taking on two negative things. I'm really going to sink this book. Nonetheless, I thought I'd do research, and I rediscovered that zoos are remarkably complicated places. They're like hospitals. They're places of many, many competing needs. So I decided to put the zoo stuff in. And so that gave me, you know, having this idea led me to research, which then gave me new ideas. So as I do research, I write down lots and lots of notes. And so at the end of my research for Life of Pi, which took about two and a half years, I had about 400 pages of notes, which I printed up, cut up with scissors, and put in envelopes depending on where they belonged in the novel. So some were directly narrative, and others were more general envelopes. Like, for example, I had a novel, I remember, on the turtles of the Pacific, the difference between a Ridley's and a greenback. Or some would be, an envelope would be like on currents of the Pacific, just how the different currents go. And then others would be directly related to the narrative. So, you know, the very first envelope that I opened when I started writing Life of Pi was one called Author's Note, and it was the author's note. And it was elements there, and some of which I used. Some would be sort of variations on the same idea. Some would be radically opposing ideas. Some would be little bits of knowledge. Some would be just simple words that I wanted to use. I spent in all about, 13 months in all in India on three trips, but the last two was when I was working on Life of Pi. So I sort of listened to how Indians spoke. I learned to be very good at imitating the Indian accent, so I could try to imagine writing, you know, speaking Indian. So I did that for about 2.5 years, and then once I felt I had enough, then I started writing. basing myself on that. So that was my process, research and then writing. Asking when I wrote the first drafts and I had all those chapter headings, and when my editor suggested I cut those, how did that feel? Well, it sucked. It was quite gutting. But I have the luck of having really, really good editors. I have a Canadian editor, my American editor, my English editor, in fact it's two people in England, and my Australian editor. And they're just extraordinarily intelligent readers. My Australian editor edits J.M. Coetzee, who's my favorite living writer. So hell, if he edits J.M. Coetzee, I'll take whatever he says about my book as the biblical truth. So I have really good editors, and so they come from the right perspective. So, you know, it's, as any of you here who writes, you write it a certain way because you think it's good and it speaks to you. You're the first reader. Your editor is your second and your third reader, and they start seeing it differently. They see things that you don't see because you're too familiar with the text. You're too in love of certain things. And so their bracing critical approach, you know, will point out things that you don't want to hear, but give it a week or two and you start seeing that maybe they're right, and then a month later you're embarrassed at what you originally showed them. So, you know, are they infallible? You know, my previous novel, Beatrice and Virgil, which had a very mixed reception. Some people absolutely hated it, loathed it, tore it to shreds. It was an allegory on the Holocaust, because the Holocaust is always represented in the same way, in the historical realism mode. Most Holocaust novels are, you know, set between 33 and 45, featuring Nazis and Jews in Eastern or Central Europe, with the familiar drama that we know from history. Nothing wrong with that kind of representation, but it's that tone is unremitting. That mode of representation is constant. Look at the way we treat war. War gets any number of treatments. You get science fiction treatments of war, war comedies, war romances. We use war. We disguise it. We play with it in any which way. We don't do that with the Holocaust. And, you know, there's obvious reasons, because it's very sad and all that, but so is war. You know, the Second World War cost the lives of 20 million people by conservative estimates, only on the Allied side of things. Forget the Axis sides or the Jews, 20 million. And, you know, yes, men and women also died in war. So they're all sad. They're all monumental tragedies. Why do we allow ourselves to play so much with war and not with the Holocaust? So it was a very difficult novel to write, not because of the tragic tone of the Holocaust, which you get used to. Once you start reading a lot of books about the Holocaust, it's a given that it's deeply tragic. You get used to the way pathologists are used to dead bodies. Yes, it's sad this child died of leukemia. You know, I have to figure out other mysteries within that body right now. You know, a pathologist doesn't burst into tears every time they see a dead body. They get used to the death. You get the sober tone. So I was questioning, what do we not lose something by limiting our representations of the Holocaust? And I thought of having this book that would be a novel on one side, then a flip book. You flip around, there'd be another text that would be an essay. And my editors hated that. And so finally I dropped it. So finally Beatrice and Virgil is just a novel. But I did write that essay. And I still sort of have lingering regrets about not having that flip book, not being boldly experimental and seeing what would happen. But generally, I have brilliant editors who, you know, you trust. You know, you always have to let go. It's a great lesson in life. You have to let go of your mortality, of everything. You also have to get go of one idea you have of your work and just let it go and see what happens to it. It's from the Isaac Luria. It's from the Kabbalah. Yeah. Thank you. I love those kinds of questions. Thank you very much. Oh, the gentleman was just pointing out that the ship in Life of Pi sinks just east of the Philippines in the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the Pacific, and it's named the Tsimtsum, and the name of the ship is a concept from Isaac Luria's cosmology from the Kabbalah, and it was this idea that if God is plenitude, if God is everything, how could he create the earth? And so God created this void within him, this void in which he created, in which creation was born. And so in a sense, God created this atheistic void, this nothingness void, and then in it was caused creation. So in a sense, we are born in a vacuum and we seek plenitude. And so I call the ship Tsimtsum because to me that was the beginning of the story. It was that void from which Pi had to escape. And therefore I had the ship be Japanese because Tsimtsum I don't speak any Japanese. Tsimtsum vaguely sounded Japanese to me, so I made it a Japanese ship. But in fact, of course, it's a Hebrew word, which is really interesting. When they translated the book into Hebrew for Israel, you know, they said, well, Tsimtsum, you know, is a Hebrew word, so what do you want us to do? Do you want us to translate that, you know, the ship is called void or absence? I forget what exactly it means in Hebrew. Or do you want us to sort of try to find a sound like void, but written V-O-Y-D-E, like some, so I can't remember what we finally decided, but it was the only problem, language where there was a translation problem, translating the title of the ship. Why did I choose Portugal? It was the first country I traveled in on my own, and it had a deep effect on me, being a lone element. I was 20, I think, backpacking around Portugal, to be exploring a foreign reality all on your own. So not in a group where you're sort of more focused on each other, but really a lone element in a great European country had a deep mark on me. But more deeply, the reason was because in the northeast of Portugal, there's a province called Trás-os-Montes, which means beyond or behind the mountains. And there are no mountains. So it's kind of bizarre. You'd call a place beyond the mountains when there are no mountains. And also that your preoccupation should not be these mountains that aren't there, but what's beyond them. And so it struck me when I saw that geography is a kind of, or specifically toponymy, the naming of places. Toponymy is a kind of storytelling. We name places to start weaving a narrative. Perfect example is the name of this country, which isn't really a name, really. United States of America isn't much of a name. America is a name, but it was already there. United States is already a narrative. We are united. We are states. We're united. It's already weaving a narrative. We do that when we name places. We name them so that we might become familiar with them, that we might feel at home. And so I thought it was very curious that they would name a place beyond the mountains when there are no mountains. What story is that trying to weave? So I decided to call my novel The High Mountains, because there are two characters observe that in part one and part three, that there are no mountains. How bizarre. They expect alpine summits. There are none. There's not even any snow. There's not much. It's just a sort of slightly elevated plateau. You have a very, very fearful sense of altitude to think that they're mountainous. So the high mountains of the title are imaginary mountains. They're magic mountains. They're mountains of the mind. They're spiritual mountains. They're aspirational mountains. And that permeates the whole novel. In a sense, part one, this is my reading. You might read something entirely different. In part one, Tomás, it's a negative quest. He's trying to conquer a mountain in his mind. In part three, I'd say Peter Tovey, the main character, and his sidekick are more like Buddhist monks meditating on top of a mountain. They're in a sort of state of grace. Part three is sort of a description of a state of grace. So I think the title, it worked for me. You'll have to see if it works for you. Thank you once again very much, Elliot Bay, for having me here, and to the library for hosting me here, and thank you very much for coming.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.